Hemlocks are Pennsylvania's state tree.
In the winter, all of the other trees are bare, and there's that iconic, everlasting hemlock tree. It's a very classic tree for the Appalachian Mountains.
But the giant evergreens are under attack from an invasive insect. I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, scientists, nature lovers, and filmmakers work to save the hemlocks.
You know, sentiment without action, you know, it's nice to be sentimental, but then there's a next step, because we're going to lose trees.
Plus, birds have been tracked with little bands on their legs for decades. But a new technology will help researchers keep an eye on birds, near and far.
We'll be able to describe very precisely, like within a meter or so, of where that bird is.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A bipartisan group of state lawmakers is backing legislation aimed at getting Pennsylvania to 100% renewable energy by the year 2050. Two identical bills introduced in the House and Senate, one by a Democrat, another by a Republican, would create a task force and a Center for Clean Energy Excellence. David Mazur from the advocacy group Penn Environment says the bills are symbolic right now and unlikely to pass the Republican-controlled legislature.
If you're familiar with politics in the Capitol, we know that the fossil fuel industry is very powerful and entrenched in the building.
But he says despite the current political dynamic, it's important to take a stand on a pressing issue like climate change. Pennsylvania already has a clean energy target of 8% renewable energy power by 2021. Later, we'll hear about the vulnerability of the electrical grid to hackers and what's being done about it. An invasive insect is killing Pennsylvania's state tree, the eastern hemlock. For our series, Wild PA, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited an insectary, where land stewards are trying a new approach to control hemlock woolly adelgid.
When I meet experts from the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy at the Bear Run Nature Reserve in the Laurel Highlands, the first thing I want to know, what is an insectary?
An insectary is basically a nursery habitat where you grow insects.
Charles Beer is the Conservancy's Director of Conservation Science. To better understand the need for an insectary at Bear Run, his colleague Andy Zednik, Director of Land Stewardship, says we should first take a walk in the woods.
Let's hit some of the trails and find some hemlock trees.
The eastern hemlocks here have come under attack by an aphid-like bug called the hemlock woolly adelgid. Beer points ahead to one of the few green spots in the chilly spring forest.
So that will be a hemlock.
It's a graceful, pyramid-shaped evergreen, but some of its soft, flat needles are looking a little sparse. Beer looks at their underside.
You can see right there, that's definitely hemlock woolly adelgid.
They look like tiny white balls of cotton, clinging where the stem meets the base of the hemlock's short needles. Adelgids, native to Japan, were first found in the eastern U.S. around 1950. The insect has decimated hemlock trees in the southern Appalachians and the Great Smoky Mountains. Beer says once infested, a tree might only last a few years.
And you'll start to see it have branches no longer holding needles, and eventually the tree is just a skeleton, and it dies.
Eastern hemlocks grow near streams and provide shade for brook trout. Many birds also rely on hemlock habitat. And while adelgids have been in the eastern half of Pennsylvania for years, they've been moving westward. Andy Zadnick says around 2009, they were found in the Laurel Highlands, at historic Falling Water, and at Ohiopyle State Park.
And when we heard about it at Ohiopyle, we knew it was just a matter of time before it made its way here to Bear Run Reserve.
There is an insecticide that helps control adelgids, but Zadnick says it's been difficult to treat enough trees.
You have to pick one tree versus another tree because it's very labor-intensive and very expensive to treat these individual trees with a chemical.
This is where the insectary comes in. Beer heard about research at Cornell University where they've been releasing a new predator beetle into hemlock groves, one that aggressively eats hemlock woolly adelgids. The insectary at Bear Run doesn't look like much now.
What do we have?
12.
Yeah, 12 little hemlocks.
Working with state foresters, the Conservancy will care for the hemlocks, preparing them to be purposely infected with adelgids.
Essentially, 1 year from now, in March, we'll consider actually starting to infect them if we think they're healthy enough.
If the adelgids take hold in the nursery, the Conservancy will introduce that predatory beetle, the Laricobius nigrinus, or LN, to feed on them. And once they've raised a population of LN beetles, they can release them more widely into Bear Run in hopes that the beetles will spread, eating adelgids off the hemlocks. LN beetles are native to the Pacific Northwest and the northern Rocky Mountains, and they already exist in eastern Pennsylvania, but they're not native to this region.
We just need to get this predator here in time to stop the hemlocks from dying in large numbers.
But is it really a good idea, releasing a new non-native species into southwestern Pennsylvania forests?
Yeah, we might look like it, but we're not really that dumb. And we're not ready to go out there and create more problems.
That's Mark Whitmore, forest entomologist at Cornell. He's been working with the USDA on regulations for releasing LN beetles to prey on adelgids.
It's like we're certain through our testing that they will only eat the intended prey item. They won't switch to other prey.
Charles Beer is banking on its success. Standing on a small bridge over the stream at Bear Run, Beer considers why the eastern hemlock is so important to him.
In the winter, all of the other trees are barren. There's that iconic, everlasting hemlock tree. It's a very classic tree for the Appalachian Mountains.
Researchers say they can't be certain, but LN beetles appear to be containing woolly adelgid in some areas and gives them hope for the eastern hemlock. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
So, eastern hemlock trees are falling to hemlock woolly adelgid, the invasive insect, at an alarming rate. And some are worried that one of the oldest stands of hemlock trees in the east will be next. Cook Forest State Park is in northwest Pennsylvania and is home to over 300 acres of old-growth forest, including hemlock trees that are hundreds of years old. In fact, the largest known hemlock by volume in all of the Northeast is there, 135 feet high and almost 14 feet around. Hemlock woolly adelgid, or HWA, is there too. David Rahm of Wild Excellence Films and his wife, fellow filmmaker Melissa Rahm, decided to do something about it. They made a short documentary, Cathedral, The Fight to Save the Ancient Hemlocks of Cook Forest. And recently I sat down with David Rahm to talk about it. Tell me a little bit about the old growth trees in Cook Forest and why you wanted to make a film about them.
Well, we spent many, many years up at Cook Forest hiking and photographing things, and it's unique, of course, because of the old-growth forest and how old these trees really are, the hemlocks. So it wasn't until one day we were with Dale Luthinger. Dale is the premier education specialist for Pennsylvania State Parks.
Cook Forest is just an incredible place, and to be able to share that with other people is a great privilege.
He didn't quite seem like himself. And we were like, hey, what's wrong? Everything okay? And he's like, the forest is in trouble. We're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, there's this new thing, this infestation in HWA. So he told us all about it. We couldn't believe it. And then we saw the pictures from, you know, North Carolina and where it first started in Virginia. Wow. You know, that could easily happen here, you know.
Yeah, what is the history of HWA, that's hemlock woolly adelgid, the invasive insect in Cook Forest?
It was discovered at Cook Forest in 2013, 2014, I believe, for the first time. So that was a very poignant day because it's so tiny and it spreads so fast. It's really important to get it early on. They've lost a few nice big trees. They're treating the trees with a chemical drench that goes in on the roots of these hemlock trees. That's the main thing. They have treated with insects, beetles, that feed on exclusively HWA. So that's having some success. So it's a multiple treatments. It's not one silver bullet.
Who is the narrator of the film?
That is Dr. Jo Maloof. She is the executive director of the Old Growth Forest Network. She's an amazing lady, does so much for forests and forest education.
The older forests are so important for so many reasons. They're important to humans, I think, as a spiritual and aesthetic touchstone, so we can see and understand what our planet does on its own when we don't interfere.
Dr. Jo Maloof, you know, she's written several books on forest ecology and forest health and forest management. She's a true expert and just a super person. And we loved her voice, too. She's got a perfect voice for that kind of thing.
Hemlock woolly adelgid doesn't have any native predators in the eastern United States. Very cold winters provide some hope and the most natural way of controlling it. The insect cannot survive prolonged or bitter cold. But with a changing climate, cold winters may become fewer and farther between.
What would it mean to lose the hemlocks in Cook's Forest to the ecosystem there and also to people?
Cook's Forest would be a much different place. Much different. You'd have great open spaces. And if you've been to Cook's Forest, there's, you know, a sheltering ability that these hemlock trees provide.
Yeah, there's a clip from Dale Luthringer.
Colder water can actually hold more dissolved oxygen, which is the oxygen that the fish breathe. Certain studies have shown that water that has flown from a deciduous forest into a hemlock forest has decreased in temperature 5 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit, which is incredible.
There's a lot of wildlife. Migrating birds love Cook's Forest, way up in the canopies. You know, they're safe there. They're protected. They reintroduced fishers there not too long ago. So it's like a mink, but a little bigger. 120 some foot trees, you know, you take away even half of them, you're going to see a huge difference. So to people, I think Cook's Forest means a tremendous amount. They get 500,000 visitors a year. More aren't going to visit if it's not the same forest.
At the beginning of the film, there's a quote sort of on the screen by writer Edward Abbey. Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul. So what do you want people to think about and to do as a result of seeing this film?
Well, a lot of people are genuinely concerned and kind of upset, you know, that this is happening. We screened this film throughout Pennsylvania and, you know, sentiment without action, you know, it's nice to be sentimental, but then there's a next step, you know. Being sentimental is not going to do it because we're going to lose trees. And this is an ongoing, huge expense for the state, for the park. So we just want to be sure, you know, people understand it's a long-term battle. They can make a small donation, make a big donation. They can get involved in work days and monitoring days. Some of the places in Cook's Forest are really hard to get to. They're on terribly steep slopes, and you know the park can't get to all of them, but monitoring can be just you're out for a hike or a walk. You know, all you have to do is turn a little branch over, and you know, you're not hurting the tree or anything, just take a look at it. And the park might not know where HWA is from year to year. HWA can get carried by wind, it can get carried by people, it can get carried by birds. So it might be in one grove one year and not in another grove, and then they treat the one grove that they saw it in, and then now it's in the new grove. Or it might not be. You know, hope's not lost. We're all very hopeful that there's going to be a technology or a biotechnology that can help eradicate HWA and help these trees. But right now, you know, we're just trying to keep up. Treatment methods are working. We say that in the film. Nothing's 100%. But the state is really committed. We want to make sure the forest is there forever, as long as we can.
When you walk through this cathedral, it does something to you. You will have a love for this ancient forest that carries through your life. Walking here, I am at peace. But never far from my mind is what could happen.
David Rahm is one of the filmmakers behind Cathedral, the fight to save the ancient hemlocks of Cook Forest. You can find a schedule of upcoming screenings and the trailer at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And all of the stories in our Wild PA series are there too. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. We've all seen birds slam into windows. Sometimes they die. And sometimes they fly away and seem fine.
There are other people who say, no, it has a concussion, like all this awareness about football players, that this is going to have some sort of long-lasting effects. And that's what we're trying to figure out.
Later on the Allegheny Front, a new technology is giving researchers a better picture of where birds go and how they fare when they get there. Stay tuned. Energy companies are on alert after the U.S. recently blamed Russia for a series of cyber attacks against power plants. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, cybersecurity is something the industry has been grappling with for years.
At the nation's largest grid operator, the report on the Russian attacks was no surprise.
You will never stop people from trying to get into your systems. That isn't even something we try to do.
Tom O'Brien works for PJM Interconnection. It serves 65 million people in the Mid-Atlantic and Midwest. The constant threats are one reason why PJM has so many layers of security around its control center.
So you are going to use your red badge against that and card in. Excellent. Come on in.
Recording equipment is banned, so the microphone is zipped into a bag and left at the security desk. Inside the control room, about 10 people are monitoring floor-to-ceiling displays, showing real-time information from power plants. As one manager puts it, this is a highly orchestrated 24/7 effort that goes unnoticed by most people, and that's the way they like it. But the industry definitely did take note 2 years ago when this happened.
But one warning, the first known hacker-caused power outage has occurred. So thousands of people in the Ukraine left in the dark, literally.
Those attacks were widely blamed on Russia. O'Brien doesn't want to get into specifics about how PJM deals with cyber threats, but one of the many lessons of the Ukraine attacks was a reminder to keep an eye out for odd communications.
A very large percentage of entry points to attacks are coming through email, and that's why PJM, as well as many others, have aggressive phishing campaigns. We're training our employees.
One way to limit exposure is by having separate systems. For example, industrial controls in a power plant aren't connected to corporate business networks. And since 2011, North American grid operators and government agencies have done large security exercises every 2 years, with thousands of people practicing how they'd respond to a coordinated physical or cyber event. So far, nothing like that has happened. And it's not very likely, says Robert M. Lee. He's a former military intelligence analyst who runs his own cybersecurity firm called Dragos.
So the more complex the system, the harder it is to have a scalable attack.
Knocking out power to the entire East Coast for a week or a month would be very hard, he says. But briefly disrupting a major city is easier. That's what keeps him up at night.
I worry about an adversary getting into maybe Washington, D.C.'s portion of the grid, taking down power for maybe 30 minutes.
The Department of Energy is creating a new office focused on cybersecurity and emergency response. But deterrence may be one reason why there has not yet been a major attack on the U.S. grid, says John McWilliams. He's with Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy.
That's obviously an act of war, and we have the capability of responding either through cyber mechanisms or kinetic military.
In the meantime, small-scale incidents keep happening. This spring, another cyber attack targeted natural gas pipelines. Four companies shut down their computer systems just in case, but they say no service was disrupted. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This week on the Trump on Earth podcast, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is surrounded by scandal for things like a huge bill for personal security.
A bulletproof desk, a soundproof phone booth for his office that cost tens of thousands of dollars.
The Scott Pruitt scandal, this week on the Trump on Earth podcast, trumponearth.org.
Usually, parents turn off video games to get their kids outside. But a game design company called Games for Change is combining the two with a competition for kids to create their own original video game focused on wildlife conservation, specifically pollinators. The contest is in partnership with the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. Taiji Nelson is a naturalist educator there.
Games are another really great way to plug into nature. Video game design really isn't my background, but it's another way for me to think about nature and really think about it in a different way.
Recently, the Frick Environmental Center in Pittsburgh hosted what was billed as a hands-on game jam, where kids could drop in and get help from experts in both conservation and game design. There were microscopes to play around with.
Is that zoomed? Like, did you zoom or is that the same?
Flowers to dissect.
It's like this fuzzy part right here.
A dried honeycomb to poke at. And a bank of computers outfitted with the latest game design programs.
Try that one. And then pick one of the other pieces of temple tile.
Heather Malik works for Games for Change and says video games can make kids appreciate nature more.
There's always that questioning of kind of, are you using a device in nature? Why are you bringing kids perhaps out of the green space into a computer? But our partnership with the parks has really led to both of us having a greater understanding of how one another engages and the connectedness. You know, they encourage citizens of Pittsburgh to be stewards. Games for Change encourages, you know, some content that was really thoughtful and creative and these kids are producing, not just consuming.
10-year-old Eamon Warner Fricky has been working on his submission from home for a while. He thinks he has a pretty good idea in the works.
Basically, you're starting off with a mini honeycomb, and your goal is to hatch more bees, create pollen, sell the pollen, upgrade your honeycomb, learn about a lot of stuff, and this will be awesome.
The Games for Change Student Challenge is geared towards kids in middle and high schools, and they're taking submissions until May 7th. You can learn more about the contest and pollinators in our region at AlleghenyFront.org. That's part of our series, Wild PA. And in June, we'll let you know who the winners are. The Trump administration recently released guidelines that would effectively weaken the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. According to the Washington Post, the Interior Department will no longer hold companies or individuals accountable when their actions inadvertently kill migratory birds, like spilling millions of gallons of oil or spraying a pesticide. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act was passed in 1918 to protect birds as they migrate across the globe. Well, now researchers have a new way of tracking birds that fly through our region. They're attaching tiny radio transmitters to the animals and putting up antennas on the ground to detect the birds as they make their journeys. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk has more from Powdermill Avian Research Center, a branch of the Carnegie Museums.
Here in the Laurel Highlands, bird calls ring out across the forest from song sparrows, dark-eyed juncos, and other species. To track the animals, researchers used to attach an ID band to a bird's leg and hope that someone, somewhere would find it, probably once it had died, and that that person would bother to report it. Luke DeGroat is one of those researchers.
We made these incredible discoveries with banding, and it still is an incredible tool. But when it comes to figuring out where birds go, it's pretty inefficient.
The Powdermill staff would band 10,000 birds a year, only to recover two or three. Their system changed 2 years ago after DeGroat heard about the MODIS tracking system.
MODIS stands for movement in Latin.
Developed in Canada, there are now 400 MODIS stations in North and South America. Researchers set these antennas up to detect tagged birds within a several-mile radius. But first, they've got to catch a bird to take it. It's snowing the day of this workshop, where researchers from across the Americas have gathered to learn about the MODIS technology. DeGroat clears some snow from a table to put down several metal cages.
I shoveled it off. I'm going to pour some birdseed. To draw them in.
An hour passes, and already a few birds have walked into the cages and taken the bait. Indoors, workshop participants watch DeGroat apply a tag to one of the birds. Each transmitter is smaller than a fingernail, with strings that stick out to broadcast a signal. It's attached to a little harness made from elastic sewing thread.
We're going to put the bird's legs through those loops, and it's going to fit over that knob that the birds have on the leg, and it's going to sit on the rump, kind of like a fanny pack.
Later, in a field nearby, workshop participants attempt to set up one of the antennas. Bob Fry from the Klamath Bird Observatory in Oregon works alongside another participant. They're trying to drive a metal anchor into the wet ground.
It's being difficult, but it's going in.
Fry is with Pablo Elizondo from Costa Rica Bird Observatories. Elizondo plans to put up 5 of these stations this year, the first in Cerro de la Muerte, or the Hill of the Dead. He says it should really be called the Hill of Life, because it's home to many of the 83 bird species that live exclusively in the highlands of Costa Rica and Panama.
It's extremely relevant for us to deploy this kind of technology because it will allow us to also track movements on some of those resident species that we know very little. So for some of these species, we don't even know if they move or not between seasons.
Plus, there are only a handful of MODIS stations in Latin America compared to North America. Yet many birds fly back and forth across the entire region. That includes the Swainson's thrush, which is what Fry wants to study in Oregon.
It's a really cool little bird. It's got a beautiful song.
The bird spends at most a few weeks in Oregon each year to fatten up before continuing its migration.
We're hoping using this MODIS system that we'll be able to describe very precisely, like within a meter or so, of where that bird is, and we'll be able to go out, do vegetation surveys, and see where that bird's been foraging, where it's been seeking shelter.
The Swainson's thrush population is in decline. Information like what Fry hopes to collect helps researchers identify threats to birds and better conservation practices. As the group breaks for lunch, DeGroat says Powder Mill is using the MODIS system to find out what happens to birds that hit windows. Some people think when birds survive a collision, they're fine because they fly off.
There are other people who say, no, it has a concussion, like all this awareness about football players and boxers, that this is going to have some sort of long-lasting effects, either immediately or possibly down the road. And that's what we're trying to figure out.
The truth, he says, is probably somewhere in the middle. It's important to pinpoint because it will help determine just how severe a problem windows are for birds and promote ways to retrofit windows to prevent those collisions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Amy Sisk.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Katherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.